Jason Brown, joined once again by my man Dr. Eric Eager and the man Luke, fresh back from his trip to the ATL. Eric, what's going on with you, my man? How you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. Big win by the Vikings, so it was fun to watch. Especially, you know, just kind of that game was over in what, 2 hours, 45 minutes, so kind of fun to have like kind of a low scoring old school affair.
And what's going on here? I feel like we got a new location for you for this week's recording.
I moved out to the living room, or from the living room to the kitchen / dining room. My wife moved stuff around to incorporate the Christmas tree. So okay. My normal setup isn't as comfortable as it normally is.
Okay, that makes sense. That makes sense. See the Christmas tree shining there in the background. And Luke, went to my hometown, kind of my second hometown, I guess would be a better way of saying it. Had some time in Atlanta. How was the trip? What did you do? What did you think about the stadium? I personally think it's gorgeous. Yeah, tell us about it, man. How you doing? How was the trip?
The stadium's really cool. The trip was excellent. I love Atlanta. I always thought Atlanta was kind of an option for ever leave LA. Like, it would be one of the cities that I would go to for both because of like I'm in the film industry and there's industry stuff there. Good things about the city, and those good things were confirmed. It is an excellent city. It is an excellent stadium. Kind of disappointed in Falcons fans. There were a few empty seats at that stadium, and there's a lot of purple.
Well, I mean, that's not surprising
for us. We got Skull Chants going.
It's not surprising for Atlanta. Atlanta is a transplant city.
They're all hungover from the Bulldogs game.
Yeah, and you know, it's a college football town. So with the SEC championship the night before, it's not overly surprising that people didn't come out. But we have some things that we're gonna get into today. Some tweets from Luke that kind of set off some conversation amongst a couple different people. And so I figured, I didn't figure. Eric said it'd be a good idea for us to talk about it today. So we're gonna talk about it. And the thing that kind of had people fired up a little bit was the touchback rule and whether or not it makes sense the way it's currently constituted. You know, someone fumbles out the back of the end zone, opposing team gets the ball on the 20. Is that fair? Does it make sense? And so, you know, we talk about a bunch of random stuff in terms of kind of the math and all of that. So this is one of those things we can tackle both from an analytic perspective, an analytical perspective, to kind of see what the numbers say, but then also get into the philosophic conversation about what should be done or what makes the most sense there. So, Luke, this is one of those things that you were kind of, I won't say fighting the good fight, but having some spirited conversation about on Twitter. So I'll let you kind of set the stage and get into this. And then I know Eric has some points he wants to get into as well. So Luke, the floor is yours.
Yeah, I think Mike Wobschall, quote tweeted somebody who was criticizing the rule, and then I responded to him, and then like a bunch of people jumped in, and it went all the way through last night, and then I woke up and people were like still fighting about it till the conversation at like 10 o'clock this morning because I had to do work. But I guess the debate about it comes down to like what people think the offense deserves and the defense deserves in that situation where like I think it was really sparked by the Sunday Night Football Carson Wentz fumbling, and then it went out of the back of the end zone, and that turned into a touchback for the Seattle Seahawks. So I guess it comes down to like what the offense deserves and whether they should be punished or rewarded, and if they're punished or rewarded enough. Best way to like classify the argument is using expected points. Explain, just to kind of make sure that we've established proper context, is like what it means when you say, if you have first and goal on the 2 and that 6.8 expected points that you have, so punching it in would be a play that's worth 0.2 expected points or whatever. I'm just kind of throwing out numbers. But essentially what that means is that if you have first and goal on the 2, you'll score on most of those opportunities. You'll score a touchdown. Opportunities, you'll score a field goal. So if you ran that scenario 100 times, on average, of points you got by that 100 times, you would like on average have 6.8 points or whatever. And that's kind of how expected points works in like game situations and how we can use it to kind of like describe the impact of certain plays, whether they're successes or failures. We can like measure them against each other that way. So I guess the main point for me is if you were to have a fumble out of the back of the end zone and have that count like any other forward fumble anywhere else on the field where it just goes back to the spot of the fumble, like a forward fumble out of bounds, kind of like the I think it was in the Ravens game, there was a Laquon Treadwell fumble where he caught it and he fumbled like sideline and it went out of bounds and it went back. The ball was spotted at where the fumble was. So if you applied that rule, you would essentially have like three possible outcomes. You could have a defense recovering the ball in the end zone. That's a touchback. Recovering the ball in the end zone. That's a touchdown. And then you can have nobody recovers it and it goes out of the zone, whether it's the side of the back or whatever. And it goes back to the spot of the tackle, or it goes back to the spot of the fumble where the fumble occurred and would effectively be like you got tackled short of the goal line. People have said a lot that seems like, oh, you're rewarding the offense by giving them the ball back, or you're forgiving the offense for their fumble. But in that scenario, it's a loss of expected points by, I think, something like 0.8 expected points. You know, you go from first and goal at the goal line is like 6.5, and then second and goal that close goes down to like 4.5 because you score touchdowns less once it's second and goal. You have fewer chances. Losing that down has value. So to me, if you can classify, hey, nobody recovered it in the end zone as a neutral outcome where neither the defense nor the offense won the battle of who's going to recover this ball, neutral outcome while still punishing the offense a little bit for dropping the ball, to me would be to put the ball at the spot of the fumble, make sure that they lost their down, and then... But I've heard a lot of other really interesting theories, stuff like calling it a quote offensive touchback where you put the ball at the 20 or start another drive first and 10 from like somewhere else on the field, and some other like really interesting creative solutions. And I think a lot of them are worth talking about. I don't know how realistic some of them are, because at a certain point, you know, the NFL is always going to be trying to make an entertainment product that people can easily consume and understand why things happen the way they do. Making that more accessible is what we do here while we're having this conversation.
Yeah. So I guess the one thing, I can't remember who said it, because I was kind of following along with your conversation for a little while there, was, I guess, one of the counter arguments to putting the ball back, you know, on the one or the two or wherever the fumble takes place, is that it reduces the need for the offensive player to be as worried about ball security when they get to the money part of the field. You could be a little bit more reckless going for the touchdown because, you know, the worst thing that's going to happen to your team is that they're going to get the ball back in prime scoring position if you were to lose the ball, out of the end zone or something like that. I guess, what is your thought about that counter argument? And how does that weigh into kind of your thoughts on how, the NFL should handle the touchback out of the back of the end zone?
I think the idea that, like, there's a few things about it. For one, players lunge for the end zone all the time, especially near the sideline. They'll lunge for the pylon all the time. So it's not like that isn't already happening. An entertainment perspective, I don't know if that's something we really want to fight against. Like, climactic lunges for the end zone are awesome. As much incentive to like try to legislate those away. And it does carry risk, even if like a fumble out of the end zone were not a change of possession. For one, fumbling out of the end zone means you don't get your touchdown, which, again, that's a loss for the offense. That's a bad play. If you lunged for the end zone and you dropped it and it went out of bounds, that was bad. Also, you know, if you lunge for the end zone and you drop it, the defense still can recover. So there is a pretty heavy amount of risk to lunging for the end zone, even if out of bounds equals a change in possession and make that a less severe punishment. Still pretty risky. And players still do it plenty on the goal line. Something that I don't think the NFL should really want to shy away from.
Okay. And Eric, I guess, what are your thoughts? Because we let Luke kind of set the stage there. I guess, what are your thoughts on the whole, you know, touchback rule and how it should go? And I guess from, I know that you did a bit of research before we got on tonight to kind of look at this from a numbers perspective. I guess, what did your research tell you about, you know, what should be done? And then I guess, what are your thoughts, you know, kind of away from the numbers in terms of your thoughts on the whole thing?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of the times our feeling towards rules in every aspect of life is shaped by the first time we encountered it. And so for me, I remember in like 1996, there were two events for the Vikings. One where Robert Griffith picked off Brett Favre and got chased down by Robert Brooks, and the ball was knocked out of his hands through the back of the end zone. And another time was, I think, Amp Lee had the same thing happen to them in the playoff game against Dallas. And I thought to myself, that's an odd thing to do, to bring it all the way back to the 20 for the defense. And at the same time, I also thought that over the course of time, I've thought, you know, the end zone is not the same as any other yard line. So, you know, throwing a 6-yard pass from the 5-yard line is different than throwing a 6-yard pass from your own 20. You know, so I don't necessarily know, you know, it makes me uneasy to think about, you know, treating it like some other fumble. That being said, it is true that, you know, the penalty is pretty harsh here. So the way that I have things calculated, you know, basically if you fumble the ball into the end zone, and you know, so one of the things Luke said that I might want to push back against is this idea of like recovering fumbles being a skill. I think recovering fumbles is very much a random thing. So if you assume 50-50, you know, a fumble into the end zone, if the offensive team recovers it, points, and if the defensive team recovers it, you know, they're basically out to the 20, which is about 0 expected points. So the average expected points on a fumble play like that is about 3.5. And at the 1-yard line, so the same thing, the ball sitting on the 1-yard line waiting to be recovered. If it's recovered by the offense, it's somewhere between 5 and 6 expected points. If it's recovered by the defense, the offense, the subsequent offense is about -1.5, 2 expected points. So it's about a difference in about 3.5 expected points. So it is like a substantial like drop, you know, 6 points, 6.5 points to 3.5 points. So there is like a discontinuity there. I view the discontinuity as simply being the fact that the end zone is a special yard line and not necessarily as something, you know, so I don't really have an issue philosophically with that rule. I think of things like the Leon Lett fumbling the ball on the back of the end zone. I think of players that fumble before, you know, you see it a lot in college where players like will hot dog before the end zone and then fumble it out of the back of the end zone, you know, while celebrating. Like, those are the types of plays that will sort of always keep me on the camp of giving a touchback to the defense. But if you're looking for a way to change it, like if you want, you know, I would say that if you want to still give the ball to the defense, it should be somewhere further back than the 20. So somewhere, you know, maybe like 10 or even their own 5-yard line, something to sort of reflect, you know, that, you know, you got a touchback or something, you know, something relatively lucky. We'll talk about that in a second. Something relatively lucky from, you know, the offense's mistake. Or if you want to keep it to the offense, I do not think they should get the ball, you know, I do not think they should get the ball anywhere near the end zone. I mean, if you're talking about, so example, if the ball's in the end zone, it's the difference between 7 expected points and 0, which is about half of that is 3.5. So 3.5 expected points, you're taking the offense back to somewhere around the 35 or the 34. And so then, you know, if you want to give the ball to the offense, I would endorse maybe giving them the ball back, you know, whatever down a distance from the 35. But then, you know, that's a discontinuity that I also think would make people uncomfortable. And we're back to the start of the argument. I think the last thing I'll say is that, you know, part of this is philosophical. I think the difference is whether you view a fumble as being an offense's mistake or a defense's, you know, the you know, sort of a positive thing the defense has done. And I would say I am more on the side of fumbles being a negative thing that the offense has done. And over the course of, you know, so defenses, their correlation rate of turnovers forced per drive is about 0.17 year to year, which is about, you know, 2 to 3 times less than their ability to like stop yards per play and things like that. So I do think turnovers are not necessarily a you know, year to year, statistically significantly characteristic of a defense. And so to me, then I think that the touchback should be more, instead of rewarding a defense, penalizing an offense. And I think part of that penalty should either be backing them way up or giving the ball to the other team.
That makes a lot of sense. And I guess, Luke, did you have any final points that you wanted to make on that before we touch on a couple other things?
I definitely like that and think that, like, moving them back to the 35 or wherever that ends up would be fair. I think that's a really good, like, compromise between the defense, that the entirety of that 7 points, but also not giving the offense back all 7 points. I think that's a great compromise. So long as you could sell that to an NFL audience and not make it like another thing that makes the NFL like inaccessible to new fans. Difference, but that's not really what this podcast is, how this podcast is going to attack things. So from a fairness perspective and from a like outcome perspective, that's a really nice solution. And I really like that. I think philosophically, my biggest issue with the rule as it is one of incentive. Like defenses, if you take a situation where there's a fumble heading out of the end zone and a defensive player is the only one who would have a shot at it, has absolutely no reason to try to possess that ball or try to go for that ball. And in terms of making an entertainment product, I think that that's a missed opportunity. There's a loose ball going somewhere. You're going to want players, no matter the context, to want a reason to try and go for it.
Is there a rule against illegally batting? I mean, I don't think it's ever been properly enforced. Like one of the Detroit in 2015 as an example, I think was it KJ Wright who just knocked it out of the back?
Yeah, and it wasn't called, but it should have been, I think, was what happened there, and it like ended up deciding the game.
I think if there was a robust means by which you can have players sort of avoiding that dynamic. I think the same thing's true though for offensive players, like almost everywhere else on the football field. Like if you're an offensive lineman and you're chasing down a fumble, like it benefits you just to kind of slide it out of bounds, you know? So I don't know. I think in terms of, you know, for the sake of fairness, right? Like to me, it's like six of one, half dozen of the other, you know?
Yeah, right. I think there's if there is a fumble heading out of the back of the end zone. I'm talking more about like if there are people going at it from both directions, right? If there's a loose ball in the end zone and it doesn't look like it's going to go out of bounds, a reason to try and go recover it, right? Because if you're a defender, you don't want the offense to fall on it and then it becomes a touchdown. The batting the ball rule, I think that definitely should be enforced, and it has been improperly enforced in the past, and that sucks and is kind of a different issue. Mm-hmm. That's another reason why I really like the solution of like backing them up further, not giving them the ball on the goal line. The only real argument for just keeping the ball at the spot of the fumble is just one of simplicity and accessibility for like fans that aren't like us.
Yeah. I think there's like fairness, though, right? Because, you know, the NFL wanted to make the kicking game more interesting. So they have this like discontinuity between if you choose to go for two, you start at the 2 yard line. And if you choose to kick an extra point, then you go from the 15, you know, and they did that from the perspective of expected points, you know, which is kind of cool. And so, you know, the NFL at least has displayed an appetite for bending the rules so as to make the game quote unquote fair. But I think it would be, you know, I don't know. I think offenses that do that, because there's enough, like Todd Gurley did it against the Seattle Seahawks this year. I mean, it's like literally almost like once or twice a week something like this happens.
Yeah. The Austin
I feel like there would be an appetite, especially in a league that wants more scoring, there's probably going to be an appetite for such a, you know, rule.
Yeah, and it's like if I were on the rules committee, I would definitely vote for a solution of like backing them up to the 40 or wherever. I guess just realistically, it's a tough sell for the Shield in the way that they typically behave in these situations. But in light of like moving the extra point or something, like they're at the 20, but kickoffs are at the 25 is another kind of confusing and accessible thing. So there is hope that maybe there can be a solution to this that is based on expected points. That's more fair, and analytics is kind of taking a hold and following in the steps of baseball. So perhaps mm-hmm. something that is very confusing and kind of counterintuitive to a casual fan, solved in a way that makes a lot of sense using math.
Slowly but surely, slowly but surely. So, you know, to pull us back from this conversation to something, you know, a little bit more accessible, to use Luke's word there, is, you know, the Vikings played a game, and it was a topic that came up on the Climbing the Pocket podcast that Miles kind of broached, and we didn't have a ton of time to get really into it. We talked about it in our kind of our group message, but I wanted to get your opinions on it. Was the Vikings win versus the Falcons kind of their biggest or most impressive win of the season when we're looking at it from an analytics perspective, or would that still be the Rams game? And I guess we'll go to you first on that one.
Oh, wow. So let me try to solve this with math. So if we go to, because I sort of look at it from the perspective of like, how much would your rating go up in a rating system? So if you go from the Vikings in 1 week to the Vikings in the next week, it's about similar. I would say, I mean, anytime that you can beat a team by multiple scores, that's an impressive thing. And I think, I can't remember, was it Justice Moss? I can't remember his last
Mosqueda,
name.
Mosqueda, yeah.
Yeah, Mosqueda. He did a study on like multiple score wins and how that's sort of a more stable, a more stable metric year to year. And although his sample sizes were pretty small. So, you know, I think he does good work, but I'm, you know, not going to, you know, totally embrace that as my, you know, power ranking dynamic. But I would say, you know, so the Rams win was at home. So you're talking about a couple points here and there given to the home team, the Viking, you know, the win against Atlanta was on the road, and Atlanta made some mistakes, you know, for example, kicking a field goal at the end when they were down by five with 5 minutes left. I mean, what are you doing? And, you know, so I would say that the Rams victory is probably more impressive because the Rams had won, you know, had been on such a roll. Atlanta's been kind of scuffling all year, and we saw, even though I think the underneath the hood for Atlanta is very strong. Quarterback's great. Their offensive line's great. We saw how good their running game could be, but they were sort of snake bitten by penalties. The Falcons showed a lot of the characteristics that have haunted them all year, not being able to score in the red zone, penalties, those kinds of things. Plus, Atlanta had some injuries in the secondary, which I think, you know, kind of hurt them to some degree. So, you know, I would say the Rams game is probably a little bit more impressive of a win. Even being at home, I just think the Rams are on such a roll that, you know, the Vikings being able to slow that's probably more impressive than, you know, beating an Atlanta team that made quite a few mistakes the other day.
Awesome. And what about you, Luke? You were there, so I know you're able to take in the whole atmosphere, watch things live. I guess, what were your thoughts coming out of that game? I know you mentioned it felt a bit like a playoff game. Did you feel like that was our biggest win of the season, or is the Rams game still the most impressive win for you?
You know, it's a really hard question. I said the atmosphere is like a playoff game, just in the way that the game felt. It was just this like heavyweight slugfest, and it was just, you were watching like good player on good player all the way across the field. Even though the score was low, you could tell that like on both sides of the ball, there were just like superstars everywhere. Perspective: the Rams are one of the most productive teams in the league. Especially on offense, so holding them to 7 points and like beating them by multiple scores, and their defenses, Atlanta's, so scoring more in that game than we did in the Atlanta game is awesome. Atlanta has a better offense though, so holding them to 9 in their old building, or I guess you could call it 12 because we didn't really earn the missed field goal. But you know, holding them out of the end zone and holding them to a really low score in their own building is highly impressive. So I don't know what you come out. I guess I would lean toward the Rams being a more impressive win, been a more productive team this year. But the fact that the Atlanta game was a win on the road also has to be considered. The more you think about it, the more I'm just really excited and hyped.
As am I.
Out of this, the Vikings are good.
Yeah, they are very good. I'm loving it. I'm loving it. And the last question I have for both of you guys today, because it has come up a couple times, and someone who, you know, I think we're all fans of here, Kevin Cole, he updated his, expected points added, or points added, excuse me, article last week. And one of the things that kind of, you know, was very easy to notice when you looked at that in terms of points added per game, Vikings quarterback Case Keenum was number three in his rankings. So it's come up, you know, I think Viking Age had an article about it today. I've seen a couple things here and there on the timeline. Is Case Keenum a legitimate MVP candidate? Eric, we'll start with you.
Oh man, I hate this. it's a fair question, right? Because they're possibly going to be the number one seed in the NFC. I think people are sick of having, although Tom Brady hasn't won an MVP in a while, people are sick and tired of like him being always like sort of the de facto. I think I was talking about this earlier. I think Case Keenum was probably one of the best free agent signings in the NFL in the last 10 years. So, you know, just in terms of like what they, you know, what they paid for him, what he's produced, what was expected of him, so on and so forth. And, you know, when you think about sort of what goes into those types of models, I think you can kind of asterisk a little bit of that idea. And that also involves QBR as well, because what goes into those models is things like running, right? They give all of the yards to the quarterback or most of the yards to the quarterback when he runs. And Keenum's been pretty effective in that realm. But they also, you know, divvy up yards by air yards versus yards after the catch. And so while Keenum, you know, 7.5 yards per attempt is, you know, top 10-ish in the league, that's really good. A lot of them are through the air. And most of the time, you talk to analytics people, they'll say, you know, air yards are for the quarterback, yards after the catch are for the receiver. And I think some of the stuff that we've done at PFF has shown that's not exactly true. You know, for example, we've started charting accuracy data for quarterbacks, and you can find that, like, you know, balls that are on the guy's frame versus balls that are out in front of a guy, that's an extra, you know, there's a statistically significantly higher amount of yak that's gained on the more accurate passes. So that means not all yards after the catch are for the receiver, right? There's a quarterback plays a role there. Additionally, like, air yards are not all the quarterback's doing. I can't remember the exact passes, like the Kirk Cousins to Josh Doctson against Oakland early in the season. But, like, you know, Cousins throws kind of a bad ball. Doctson comes back and snags it over the top of David Amerson, rolls into the end zone. And, like, you know, we at PFF would not give that a very high grade. We would give the grade to the receiver. But a statistic that measures air yards as being characteristic of a quarterback would. And so, you know, when you look at, like, those kind of metrics, Case Keenum's going to do very well because he's throwing the ball down the field and, you know, he's been accurate enough. So I'm not going to take a ton away from him, but I will say that, you know, he is not responsible for all those air yards. You know, the Vikings receivers have done fantastic work on contested catches this season. 50-50 balls aren't. They're something like, you know, 20-80 balls or 25-75. And guys like Thielen and Diggs make them more towards 50-50. So I think we should, you know, give maybe a little bit more credit to the receivers. That being said, I mean, I think Case Keenum is one of the best stories in the league this year. You guys all know how I feel about Teddy, so I'm super conflicted. But I do think, you know, guys like Tom Brady, I think Russell Wilson is, you know, given what he's had to deal with, is a far better candidate for MVP. You know, I actually think Keenum and Wentz are kind of similar to each other in that regard. So, you know, I think the fact that he's even in the conversation makes that one of the best free agent signings that the Vikings have ever had, that we've ever seen in the league, quite frank.
And what about you, Luke? Where do you weigh in on this? Case Keenum, MVP? I'm with Eric there. I think that just based on what's going on around Russell Wilson and what he's been able to do, he would be kind of my vote for MVP at this point. But I guess maybe if Case isn't the actual MVP of the league, I guess how far up the list would you feel comfortable putting him based on what you've seen and what you've seen kind of in the numbers around him? Because it's tough to find a number related to Case Keenum that isn't, you know, good or at least above average. I mean, even with PFF, where he started a little low, he started to creep up. I think he was 13th the last time I looked. So, I mean, where do you kind of weigh in on this debate in terms of Case Keenum as a legitimate MVP candidate?
I think the fact that we're having this debate, I think there's an important lesson to be learned about like context in statistics, you know, and like, it's no secret that I love using statistics as an evaluative tool. Like, duh, I'm on this podcast, but it's important to consume them with some level of thoughtfulness and sentience. And it's important to like not let statistics stop you from critically thinking. So like this last game was a great example, right? I think Case Keenum had like a 120 passer rating, 2 touchdowns, 227 yards. He didn't throw a single incompletion in the second half. Like statistically, all of that, and it doesn't matter how advanced the statistics get, everything is going to reward him with a very, very good game, with an excellent, like elite MVP caliber game. But putting it in context, he attempted, I think, only 3 passes beyond 15 yards. All of them were pretty inaccurate. I think only 74 of 227, if my memory serves right, were of those yards came in the air. Only 74 of them came in the air. So it's definitely easy to get wrapped up in those things. And, you know, the measures like QBR, measures like stuff that respects air yards versus yards after the catch, stuff that's doing really, really smart things statistically, is still going to miss on something like, you know, well, he got that Jerick McKinnon touchdown because of the play design, and really any quarterback could have made that play. And I think the MVP award has to be, you know, it's the most valuable player. And this is more of a philosophical debate about like what the MVP award is. Is it the best player, or is it the one who's providing the most to his team, or the one that would like, if you lose him, you would lose the most, like Aaron Rodgers style. But I think like Russell Wilson, with what's going on around him, I don't think really can hold a candle to that. Tom Brady, as much as we're sick of him, you know, he's doing the same thing again with a continually rotating in and out cast of, can consistently get to 14-2. And I think with what Case Keenum has around him, with Thielen and Diggs, and with these red zone play designs, creating all of these red zone touchdowns, none of which are particularly difficult throws, it's really hard for me to give him that, even though statistically he's having a year that is like top five outside of top five. It's more of an endorsement of the passing offense as a whole. And I think it's erroneous to just like give it to Case Keenum automatically, because quarterbacks are most responsible for the success of the passing game, but it still behooves us to be smart about that and to look at it with like some level of sentience.
So what you're saying is Big Sherm for MVP.
I mean, kinda. Coordinator of the year, baby.
Shermer's the assistant coach of the year. I mean, I can't see how the way that offense has turned around. I mean, obviously, like, I have to look across the league, but like, he's done a fantastic job, right? One of the stats, so Case Keenum had 50 yards. 50 of his 227 yards the other day were on passes that were thrown behind the line of scrimmage. 59 of his yards were on passes thrown 10 yards or more beyond the line of scrimmage. So, you know, those kind of cancel out. Most of his work was done from 0 to 10 yards. He completed 0 passes that traveled more than 20 yards in the air. So, I think that context is, as Luke said, I think that that's important. And I think that, you know, I think that you can, you know, be confident in saying that he's doing his job really well. But I think that somebody like Shermer, you know, Pat Shermer is sort of making his job one that he can do well. And I think that he, you know, he deserves a ton of credit for that as well.
So, Luke, I guess, where would you rank him in terms of the MVP race?
I don't know. I think about, like, if you put every quarterback on this offense, where would Case Keenum rank every quarterback in those situations, and ran that simulation up somewhere in the middle of the pack? That, like Eric said, that's not to say that what he's been asked to do, you know, in the second half of that game, he wasn't asked to do particularly difficult things. Well, that's still important. It's still important to be accurate on short passes, to give your yards after the catch opportunities. particularly difficult to do that. And I think that a lot of the production, especially in the red zone, has come from not very difficult throws. And a lot of those plays, like the Jerick McKinnon one, the wide open Rudolph touchdown on the Thanksgiving game, the there was a screen touchdown to Jarius Wright in the Redskins game. Touchdowns are plays that, you know, 29 out of the top 30 quarterbacks in the league can make.
Thielen housed that pitch pattern against the Rams, right? So he's just a 5-yard throw and then a 70-yard touchdown. I mean, again, I don't think this is so we last season, whether that be scheme or whether that be context or whatever it meant, you know, supporting cast, they were not getting this offensive production out of Sam Bradford and company, right? So, like, you know, you roll that in, you say, okay, well, you know, the Vikings are being a very productive offense now. And the question becomes like, well, what's the difference? And I think we'll all say, oh, Case Keenum. And then you forget the fact that Shurmur has had an entire offseason to figure out ways to getting Keenum, or you know, actually it was Bradford at the beginning, right? Third and manageable, right? Because their issue was they were having so many third and longs because they couldn't have success running the football on first down, second down, that kind of thing. Latavius Murray, I think another really, really good free agent signing, right? You know, reasonable contract, backup role, comes in. He's played the role of a backup running back, taking over for a starting running back about as well as you could have asked. Riley Reiff's been a very, you know, been, as we talked about last podcast, a huge upgrade going from the worst left tackle in the league to an average, possibly above average left tackle. Same thing at right tackle with Hill and with Remmers. You know, the interior of the offensive line is far improved from a season ago, even if the PFF grades don't show it, I think. And then, you know, Kyle Rudolph, they're using him a lot better, right? They're putting him in positions to succeed. There haven't been that many plays where I'm like, why are they throwing the ball to Rudolph? Which happened to me a lot last year, with the short throws on third long. Even like a guy like Laquan Treadwell is being put in position to look good when his opportunities arise, which, you know, that again speaks, I think, to Shurmur. Jarius Wright's the same thing, right? We never see Jarius Wright do poor things. He's only making surprising third down conversions every so often. McKinnon, Murray, David Morgan. I think, you know, I can't, you know, we should figure out a way to quantify this, but I think it's a lot. I mean, Shurmur, you know, commendable work so far this year, for sure.
Absolutely. I am right on board with you. And I looked at a couple of things. So when I did my my Sam Bradford, you know, which is crazy to think of when I wrote that article about a possible Sam Bradford breakout this season and kind of where the season has gone and Sam Bradford becoming kind of the forgotten man of the Vikings. But the factors that I looked at the time were, you know, how important your weapons are to the quarterback success. And obviously the thing that we found that Eric confirmed for me after the fact was that, you know, having great weapons, great wide receivers are obviously a huge boost to a quarterback's production. Your pass blocking, the ability for your offensive line to pass block isn't huge, but you don't want them to be terrible. And then something that I added in kind of after the fact, based on some things that, you know, Luke had tweeted and written about, that, you know, Yanka wrote about, and then Arif had talked about on a podcast, which was the rush success rate and kind of how that can have a positive impact on a quarterback. And when I kind of put everything, you know, in the blender and pulled it out here, Case Keenum is getting kind of the second most help of any quarterback in the league, just kind of based on what I was looking at, behind only Drew Brees. So for him to be performing at the level that he is right now, it's commendable, absolutely, but it makes sense. The situation that he's in is a phenomenal situation. So it's not to take anything away from him. He's executing. He's doing the things that he needs to be doing within the context of the scheme that we have and the weapons that we have available to him. But, you know, Russell Wilson, based on what I was looking at there, is getting the 13th least amount of help, I guess we'll say, in terms of quarterbacks in the league, and is still out there balling week over week. So that's why, from my perspective, I put him as my MVP candidate, because he's still able to do it with so little help around him.
Well, but
it's just important to like be smart about, you know, it's arguable that the Vikings have one of the top passing offenses in the league, right? The passing offense is incredibly effective. And there's a whole bunch of different ways to measure that. And they're all going to tell you the Vikings passing offense is very good. important that we understand and be thoughtful about who we're assigning the credit to for that success.
Yep. I think at the same time, we want to make sure, especially as Vikings fans, which we all are, we want to shy away from, you know, if the Vikings win the Super Bowl and it's because their passing offense is good, I don't think at some point it's not going to matter that Case Keenum was only 50% of that or 35% of that or 75% of that. But, you know, so same time, I've always shied away from saying, you know, Keenum's not very good. You know, let's wait for the regression. There is a possibility that Pat Shurmur has just figured this thing out, right? But to Jason's point, if the Seahawks lose Paul Richardson this week to an ACL, the Seahawks passing offense is probably going to be okay. If the Vikings lose Adam Thielen to an ACL this weekend, the Vikings passing offense is probably not going to be okay. That to me is kind of the difference.
Yep, I think that hits the nail on the head there, and I think that pretty much covers everything that we had lined up. I guess before we go, Eric, I know that you're still doing some work, putting some final tweaks on there, but I guess is there anything of yours, any work that we should be on the lookout for? What you got cooking up for us, man?
Yeah, so I'm just finishing up my article on the PFF ratings. I think where are the Vikings this week? 32nd. No, I'm just kidding. They are going to be, I believe fourth behind the Eagles, Steelers, and Patriots. Eagles, kind of just because they were second last week, fell to third. Steelers, you know, are one of those teams. You know, so all of those teams, I think the really cool thing about it is the Vikings are in the same Patriots, Steelers, Eagles, Saints, Rams, Falcons, all those teams. So that's fantastic. We did Sam Monson, the sort of senior analyst at PFF, is going to do a wins prediction article where we kind of mash our numbers together. And we have the Vikings finishing the year somewhere between 12 and 13 wins, which would be, you know, basically the highest for the Vikings since either 2009 or 1998. So that's a pretty cool thing if you're a Vikings fan. So, and, you know, we have the spread picks coming out on Friday. I don't want to give it away too much, but I'm pretty sure that we'll like the Vikings -3 or -2.5 at Carolina this week. So if you want some, you know, we did give out the Atlanta Minnesota under during the Climbing the Pocket podcast. We also did predict that Atlanta would win, so we were 1-1 there. So who knows? But yeah, good. You know, all signs are pointing pretty upward for the Vikings from the PFF perspective.
Love it, love it, love it. And Luke, what do you have on deck for us? Since, you know, your articles hold immense power over what will be happening for the Vikings in the future. What is the next thing
that you're going to write for us?
Yeah.
We can expect some sort of significant Ben Gedion injury in the future.
Oh no. Oh no.
I just wrote, came out this morning, Tuesday morning, a piece about Ben Gedion and how he's been doing a little bit of storytelling about how we all thought he was a reach in the draft and how he's like totally smashing those expectations. I don't know, his PFF grade is something like a 76 or so. It's like super solid. I'm very happy with Ben Gedion. So go check that out. That's at Purple PTSD. You can find me on the Purple Journal podcast and stuff. I finally got one of my I do a bold prediction on that show every week, and I finally got one right. I haven't gotten one right since I predicted Jameis Winston to have 3 picks in the Tampa Bay game all the way back in week 3. So I finally got a bold prediction right, and I feel pretty good. It was that Julio Jones would be outproduced by both Diggs and Thielen.
Ooh. Not too shabby.
I have no idea what it's going to be
last week, but in run defense, he has been solid. He has graded solid for us this year.
And he's only been targeted once in coverage, so it's kind of like a neutral. He hasn't been tested at all in coverage, so it's hard to know. Yep. He's been given really easy assignments. It's like super zero plays all over the place.
Well, all right, gentlemen, this was fun. you know, we went deep there on the touchback stuff, brought it back with a little bit of a Vikings talk and Case Keenum MVP candidacy. It's a lot of fun. I will get this chopped up and on the interwebs here for first thing tomorrow morning. So once again, everyone, thank you for listening to us. My name is Jason Brown here, as always, with Eric and Luke. Y'all have a good one.